Major funding for the connection is provided by Macromedia, the software company helping to redefine what the web can be. Available on the web at www.macromedia.com.
I'm Anthony Brooks, in for Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. There was a time when almost every home had a coal bin, and miner strikes were front page news, when everyone was aware of the role that coal plays in American life. Today, a miraculous rescue brings coal miners and coal mining back into public consciousness. But a remarkable story of luck and pluck and savvy engineering is not the complete picture. Coal still fuels more than half the electricity generating plants in America, even though the number of coal miners is steadily declining. Meanwhile, some of the great old mountains of Appalachia are literally being chopped off to bleed the seams of coal that lie beneath. It's not coal strip mining anymore. It's mountaintop removal. A federal judge has now ruled that dumping debris from the flattened hills into streams may violate the Clean Water Act. The coal companies say if they can't get at the coal, they can't stay in business, and they can't provide America with the power it demands. Connection listeners, do you know the hard facts of coal? Do you think mountaintop removal and valley fills are a necessary environmental compromise? And if not, how should we realign our energy priorities? 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK, or join us online at theconnection.org. Joining us today are people who know the West Virginia coal industry in their bones. We'll start with Cindy Rank, chair of the Mining Committee of the West Virginia Highlands Conservancy. Hello, Cindy.
Hello.
Thank you for being with us.
Sure thing.
And Bill Rainey, president of the West Virginia Coal Association. Welcome to you, Bill.
Good morning, Anthony. Thanks.
Sure. It's good to have you here. Cindy, let me start with you. Your organization brought one of the first big federal lawsuits against the practice of dumping debris from mountaintop removal into valleys and streams. There was another ruling the other day. Explain to us what you hope to accomplish in those lawsuits and why.
Well, what we see happening with coal is that some of the newer technologies of coal mining, especially strip mining, are taking apart whole mountains and destroying the environment of a great portion of southern West Virginia. And what we're looking to do through these lawsuits is to bring these mining operations back in line with both the Surface Mine Act and the Clean Water Act, which we think would prevent some of the major impacts from these mining operations.
Cindy,
we're looking to limit them.
The Surface Mine Act, it's the 25th anniversary today, I understand, the signing of that act.
Well, it's actually Saturday is the actual
coming up Saturday. I think it might be useful for the purposes of this discussion, a lot of people listening who don't know a lot about coal mining, just give us a description of what happens with mountaintop removal.
With mountaintop removal, we have very steep mountains with several seams of coal laying in throughout the mountains like a layer cake, and the coal seams are like the frosting in the cake. And what we do with mountaintop removal is we take off not just the very tippy top of the mountain to get at the first or the second seam, but industry is now taking apart as much as 1,000 feet deep the entire mountains to get at maybe 16 splits or seams of coal and truck them out to someplace else. And in order to do that, all of the cake or the rock that's between those coal seams has to be put out of the way. And what we're seeing now is that the waste rock that's in the way when you're trying to get all these thin seams of coal out is then pushed into the valleys. And most of those valleys have streams, sometimes intermittent and perennial, most of the time intermittent and perennial streams. And so those streams are being buried. Mm-hmm. And we're losing the forests that are on the hillsides. And what's being put back is going to take a long time, if at all, to return the hardwood forests. And the communities down below, of course, are suffering damages from the larger mines right now, because they're taking apart whole mountains, involve a lot of blasting, involve a lot of, therefore, dust and change of wind currents.
Cindy, let me bring Bill Rainey
sure.
in. Bill Rainey, who's president of the West Virginia Coal Association. Bill, Cindy painted a pretty stark picture that I'd like you to put into context. Why is it important to be able to do this kind of mining?
Well, that's, of course, Cindy and I have been describing that process for about 20 years, I guess, across the table from one another, and she looks at it, I think, from perhaps a negative standpoint. I look at it from a beneficial standpoint. It's a remarkable exercise in technology. And it's not every mountain in West Virginia. There's only 1% of the land that is being disturbed in that manner. As a matter of fact, it's less than that. And the county where it's occurring most has a 5%. So, and that's being put back. And you do have to move the dirt and rock. Anthony, you talked about the debris, or whoever had the lead in on this thing.
That was me.
Talked about the debris and chopped off the mountains. And that's typically what we deal with when it's journalistically represented somewhere outside West Virginia, even inside West Virginia.
So that's not a fair description to say the top of the mountains are chopped off?
No, I got a bunch of coal miners that show up every day and are very proud of what they do, and they don't want to destroy the mountains. Their intent is not to do that. It's a construction project in which we're producing a product that goes to make electricity for not only West Virginia but the country.
And a lot of electricity for a lot of the country. And we want to get to that, but stick with the mountaintop removal just for a bit.
It's a very sophisticated engineering process in which large machines are used, and again, it's not the majority of our production in West Virginia. The majority of our production is done by underground mining. And about 60%, maybe Cindy's got a different number. We'll talk about whether the numbers are accurate or not. But 30% of our coal is done by surface extraction methods. That includes mountaintop mining.
Mm.
And I believe about 60-65% of that surface production is done by mountaintop mining.
Bill, let me just read you a description and get you to react to it and bring Cindy back into the conversation. Federal Judge Charles Hayden, who was involved in this court decision in this case, he said this, quote, he flew over examples of mountaintop removal, and he wrote, "The site stood out among the natural wooded ridges as huge white plateaus. The valley fills appeared as massive, artificially landscaped stair steps. Tree growth was stunted or non-existent. The mine sites appear stark and barren and enormously different from the original topography." He was pretty moved by what he saw.
Well, yes, he was. His opinion indicated that.
Yeah.
And certainly that's what happens when you take a tour like that. And I believe that was in February that occurred. And everything was snow-covered, so it was white.
I see.
And the trees are not there because, as I say, you've got a construction project in which you're moving dirt and rock to get to the coal seams. Mm-hmm. And granted, we're beginning to learn more about the reforestation of these areas. Typically, there are a variety of reasons that reforestation, with particularly hardwoods that are native to West Virginia, have not been utilized in that effort. They have been utilized in some places, but typically the system and the procedure diminished the importance, not the importance of that, but it just guided you away from using that. We're learning more about that.
Bill, stand by. I want to get Cindy back in there. Cindy Rank, there's an irony here, even a contradiction. Mountaintop removal, as I understand it, is an effort to get at the more environmentally friendly coal, low-sulfur coal,
mm-hmm.
But in a way that environmentalists like you say devastates the landscape. I mean, there's a contradiction here, isn't there?
Well, if you take into account the true costs of mining that coal, I'm not sure it's environmentally friendly. It might be environmentally more friendly than burning higher sulfur coal in the electricity-producing plants. But if you take into account the true cost, the full cost of this, you have to take into account the fact that we're losing not only hardwoods and the ecosystems in a great expanse of this area. And Bill says 1%, but in mapping the permits that are out there, if you look at the 13 counties where this is happening, it's closer to 20% already, and there are some 60 or 80 new permits that are waiting to go online whenever Judge Hayden's rulings are settled one way or the other. And the fact that for years it has been cheaper just to dump the topsoil into the valleys first thing and have replanted on top of the reclaimed areas, grasses that are easy to grow but not very conducive to bring back the hardwoods, you have an industry that has been flaunting what the original intent of the Surface Mine Act was when they said you should save the topsoil and all of the bugs and critters and seeds that would produce what you found there before. And it's only through the lawsuits that we have been able to force the industry to once again look even at the beginnings of trying to replant and replace some of the hardwood, the very valuable, most productive and diverse hardwood forests, temperate forests in the world are located in these areas.
Let me stop Cindy there, Anthony.
Go ahead, Bill Rainey.
We got to keep in mind that West Virginia is, I think, 76% forested. I believe, and Cindy will correct me if I'm wrong, I think that's the third most forested state in the nation. The forests are coming back, and granted, we do have those interruptions, if you will, as we have the projects where we're mining the coal. And as I said, you know, we're getting better about the reforestation. The concern we have is that they're typically forcing, and they is not the right term. I mean, it just the system is encouraging the reconstruction of these extremely steep slopes, and we're finding that to have an implication on the flooding that we've had.
However, the law has, from the very beginning of 1977, insisted that when you do these mountaintop removal mining sites and leave them somewhat flattened rather than steep, which are variances which are allowed under the law, you have to have some constructive purpose for what you've left.
Cindy,
let me
just jump in just to clarify. You're talking about a law, the Surface Mining Control and Reclamation Act, or
yes.
SMCRA, which is it fair to say that law says if you mine it, you have to restore it more
yes.
or less?
Correct.
Okay.
And we are restoring.
And one of the provisions of that act is if you're going to do mountaintop removal mining and leave those sites somewhat more level in the end, you have to have constructive purpose that someone who lives in that area can see a value of equal importance as the coal was before and the forests were before it was mined. We have 300,000 acres or so of already mined lands which are not being put to any constructive purpose, and the cheapest way, not the most sophisticated constructive way, the cheapest way to reclaim those was to put grasslands up there, which is not an acceptable part of that law. So we have skirted the issue of what was required by law and what the impacts have been to the communities as well as to the whole ecosystem.
Stand by, Cindy. We need to take a short break, and I want to give the last word in this segment to Bill Rainey. Bill, the trick seems to be is to balance environmental concerns with economic needs, and Cindy's suggesting that's not happening.
Well, I suggest that it is happening, and of course it depends upon the foundation information that you utilize. If you truly come down here and take a look, It is occurring. I'm very proud of what our people do, and our people are proud of what they do, and most of them live in the vicinity of the sites that they're mining. And the last thing in the world they're going to do is cause any harm to that.
Okay, Bill Rainey, stand by. We're going to take a short break. I would like you to stay with us. We're going to come back to you after the break. Cindy Rank, we say goodbye to you, Chair of the Mining Committee of the West Virginia Highlands Conservancy. Thank you for joining us today on The Connection.
Sure thing.
When we return after the break, Connection listeners, we're going to be asking, what about our energy priorities and policies? We worry about environmental degradation, but do we have the policies in place to keep our air conditioners and our electrical needs running? This is The Connection. I'm Anthony Brooks. We'll be back after a short break.
From Boston University.
This is The Connection. I'm Anthony Brooks, in for Dick Gordon. We're talking about coal and America's unquenchable thirst for electricity and the demand for cheap, clean energy. To join this discussion, call 1-800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK, to make the energy and coal connection. With us is Bill Rainey, president of the West Virginia Coal Association, and we're joined as well by Norm Steenstra, who's joining us. He's executive director with the West Virginia Citizen Action Group. Thanks for being with us, Norm.
Thank you, Anthony.
And Lee Saperstein, dean of the School of Mines and Metallurgy at the University of Missouri in Rolla. Dean Saperstein, thanks for being with us.
Good morning to you both.
Great. Great to have you all here. Norm Steenstra, let me start with you. First of all, something about your background. You have a miner's background, is that right?
I was in the industry for 13 years, and for 13 years now I've been an environmental advocate and lobby at the legislature.
But you were a mine owner and have the background of a miner. So, you know, jump in and pick up the conversation that was going on before the break. And that is, there seems to be a disconnect here between what the nation is demanding, more cheap, clean energy, and environmental concerns. Mountaintop removal is a way of getting at the less polluting coal.
Well, I think what Cindy was trying to get at and said, I thought quite well, was that who's paying the true cost of electricity? And we in West Virginia, at least our side of the issue, feel like no one is paying the true cost of electricity except perhaps West Virginians. And in order to provide cheap power to the East Coast, the air conditioner you're using right now, we have a cost. And that cost includes an environmental liability, a social liability, a quality of life liability. And at the same time, coal makes up a vital part of our economy. It continues to be, I think, one of the top taxpayers in the state. And there's a constant balance attempt for balance going on in West Virginia and all of Appalachia in the coal mining regions as to how much of the liability, how much do you subsidize your cheap electricity in Boston for our what we have to pay in costs that are generally don't show up in a ledger.
And the kind of costs you're talking about are environmental degradation. You're also talking about all kinds of other social costs as well.
Sure, bankrupt workers' compensation system, subsidizing bridges and roads so that and docks and locks that transport the coal, the quality of life issues, the broken backs of miners, the yellow streams from acid mine drainage. There's a cost to mining coal that I don't think the people that are cooling in your studio right now realize.
I'm sure you're right. Lee Saperstein, dean at the School of Mines and Metallurgy at the University of Missouri. Jump in here. Hello there. There's a broader picture that Norm Steenstra says people like us sitting in air-conditioned studios in Boston have to be aware of.
Yeah, your electricity was probably oil generated, but that's another story for another time. I'm having a Yogi Berra moment here because I was involved in looking at research in surface mining as early as 1967, 68, and watched the generation of the Surface Mine Act as it came from the various state laws, Pennsylvania's Clean Streams Act, Pennsylvania's Coal Reclamations Act, West Virginia had an act, and so forth. And the story then was, in many ways, similar to what we're hearing now, but it was worse. And there was a very real need for control. And so when I first learned of the mountaintop removal suit, I was somewhat surprised. And then not really, because as was so ably said, this is their backyard. This is the place where they live. And they want it to be done as responsibly as possible. Although, Norm, perhaps there's an element of not my backyard, which follows any major construction task as Bill has described it.
But I guess Norm's point is that part of the world isn't reaping a whole lot of the benefits of the industry that is on their backs.
Anthony, let me interject.
Yeah,
here.
Please do. This is Bill Rainey.
Yeah, I'm sorry. This is Bill Rainey, and the dean's exactly right. It's substantially improved. I think Norm will agree to that as we move through the years. You know, the suit was all about. This most recent suit in Kentucky was about a higher and better use for lands in which you use the hollow fills. And we're down to very specific kinds of things. In terms of protecting the environment, I think we do a tremendous job. There's a long legacy, and the industry's paying a tax to take care of that. But, you know, I've got 16,000 people that show up every day at a mine digging coal so that you do have electricity in Boston and the Midwest and the Southeast. And we're very proud of that. And they feel like that they benefit as a result of showing up and getting a very good wage. They're the most skilled industrial workers. You saw that in the Pennsylvania incident that we just had, of what tremendous technology there is in terms of the miraculous rescue that occurred.
Norm Steenstra, respond to Bill Rainey. You've got a lot of workers there who have a lot of pride in their work, and this is would have a huge impact on the local economy if you were to make it too difficult for them to do their jobs.
Well, there's been a shift. You know, the Clean Air Act in the early 90s shifted production from the high sulfur fields in the northern part of the state, when hundreds and hundreds of maybe thousands of miners lost their job, but the production just shifted to the southern part of the state. I said it in the beginning, coal is a vital part of West Virginia's economy, but is it a trade-off that the average citizen of West Virginia benefits from, or is even it's even? And I don't feel it is.
Let me just throw the number out and invite our listeners to join us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK to join the Coal Connection. And we want to hear from Jeff, who's on the line from Chapel Hill, North Carolina. Hello, Jeff.
Hello. As a native of Eastern Tennessee and Eastern Kentucky, I can tell you that the reason I moved out of that state is because the economic and environmental devastation that the coal industry has brought. And I would like to ask your guest there, if you summed it all up, I mean, coal has lost jobs. There's been a net loss of coal jobs since the 60s. And if you summed it all up, is coal good for Appalachia? It's devastated the landscape. It's devastated the workforce, and it's devastated the culture, I think, by flattening the mountains and ruining the streams. It really has a cultural impact.
Well, let's let Bill Rainey respond to that. You've responded to it already, but take another go at it, Bill.
Well, you know, the young man, I appreciate him calling from North Carolina, which they use an enormous amount of coal-fired electricity in North Carolina, and we're very appreciative of that. And much of it is Appalachian coal that is shipped down there to make that. What I do ask him, and it's not devastating. Naturally, you're not going to expect me to say that it's devastating Appalachia. I've lived here all my life. I grew up here. I started out in a coal camp, and I don't have any intention of moving. I don't want to move, and I'm proud of that. And most of the 16,000 people that I know live close to these operations, and they've stayed there, and they don't want to do any harm to that vicinity. Particularly the locale where they're operating. But let me ask Norm, I'll ask the dean who comes out of academia. We hear all this criticism of coal,
Bill,
the use of it. What is the alternative?
It's a great question, Bill. I mean, the fact is more than 55% of all electric power is generated through coal-fired power plants. Dean Saperstein, I mean, what are we going to do?
Well, part of the alternative is social. People who vote may also decide to turn off their air conditioners, take to their bicycles, move back into the cities from the suburbs, cut transportation costs, and so forth. But let's just assume that we need the amount of energy that we use, and so what are our alternatives? Coal, oil, natural gas, nuclear, a very small amount of electricity is hydro-generated. That's not small if you happen to be in Bonneville Power by the Columbia River. And an even smaller amount of renewables, either solar or biomass. And every one of those have consequences. Hmm. So one shifts the consequences from one area to another. My school has got mining department, petroleum department, nuclear engineering department, and we try to maintain the balance.
Can I jump in here?
Yeah, Norm Steenstra, go ahead.
I don't think there is a short-term alternative to coal. And maybe we're talking about an entire generation of continued dependence reliance on coal as our chief energy source. But what happens is, because we are not paying the true cost of electricity, there is little incentive, if any, to go beyond fossil fuels to put research and development money into other ways to develop or to provide energy to the country. It's the same thing with the internal combustion engine.
Gee, I'd contest that. There's a great budget in the Department of Energy looking at each one of the fuels and looking at the alternatives. And I'd also suggest that the Surface Mining Act, which is an extraordinary act for the United States because it has tremendous implications for what people may do with their private resources, that has gone a long way toward internalizing the costs.
Hmm. Let me go back to our caller. Jeff, are you still with us from Chapel Hill, North Carolina? Up, we lost Jeff. Thank you for your call. Let's go to Eric from Marlboro, Massachusetts. Hello, Eric.
Yes, hello. Mr. Rainey has called the mining a construction project, but right now it's not because they're not constructing anything with the rock. So I'm wondering about the common sense idea of actually using it for home building and bridge building and road building and trying to market it to builders and municipalities that way. Has anybody thought
about
that?
How about that, Bill Rainey? Is that something that
we've got counties looking at long-term land use plans, trying to dovetail that with the diversification of the economy and the coal fields of West Virginia. You know, one of the tremendous problems that we have in West Virginia is the God-given topography that we have. It's not a problem. It's a challenge. And only about 2% of the very steep southern West Virginia is usable for construction purposes as it naturally sits. And the enormous cost of that is the earth moving. And we're getting a lot smarter about coordinating the mining operation with the dirt moving as it regards a long-term construction or a building.
Bill, this is Lee. I thought Eric's question was whether the overburden can be used as a commercial byproduct. And the volume.
You need to define the terms, Lee Saperstein. Overburden, what they take away from
the top
of the
mountain.
That's
right. You've been calling it debris. The miners call it overburden.
Okay. Right.
And the volumes of rock are just enormous and far greater than needed in the construction industry. And then you have quality issues. The stone that goes into concrete, into our roadbeds and so forth, meet certain criteria, and very few of the overburden strata would actually meet those criteria. That's why we have a separate mining industry called quarrying.
Let's go to David, who's on the line from Winston-Salem, North Carolina. Hello, David.
Hello. The coal industry, they're doing everything they can to reclaim the land. I mean, they're planting grass, they're doing all the erosion control, and it just seems to me like, you know, these environmentalist tree huggers are, you know, forcing them, you know, oh, let's stop the coal industry. Hey, I want my air conditioning.
Yeah.
And, you know.
David, what's your background? Are you involved in the coal mining industry?
No, I am not.
Okay.
Though my grandfather was a coal miner. My great-grandfather was a coal miner. My daddy shoveled coal as a child. But no, I'm not in the coal industry, but we need to get off the coal industry's back.
You say they're doing everything they can to reclaim the land. Are they doing everything they can or everything they have to?
I think they're doing everything they can. You know, sure, they don't have hardwood forest, you know, where they've reclaimed the land, but they're planting grass, and Mother Nature's going to bounce back. You know, you just got to give it time. The land will come back. The land will come back, but we need the coal, and we need that industry.
Norm Steenstra? Respond to David.
Well, I guess it's no surprise I disagree. Your question, your response back to him is, are they doing everything they can or everything they have to? And it's a constant battle for activists and people like myself to keep from the laws from eroding, the regulations, the rules. And then what we have here in West Virginia is a real culture of non-enforcement. Coal is such a political power in this state. Laws don't get enforced. We have a classic example going on right now with overweight coal trucks that the industry has admitted for 20 years. They have deliberately flaunted the law, and it hasn't been enforced. And that permeates environmental and health and safety laws as well. We are not enforcing those laws. On paper, SMACRA is a good law. We have many good, strong mining laws in West Virginia. It's the amount of enforcement and the political will that pushes that enforcement that we really have a lack of.
But Norm, isn't it also a question of the will of consumers across the country to really sort of change the way they think about this? I mean, don't we need to talk about that as well?
Well, if I was living in North Carolina and had my air conditioner on, I certainly wouldn't care or worry too much about what the conditions are or what the state of West Virginia's taxpayers do to subsidize their power.
Hmm. Anthony,
yes.
Let me interject
yes,
here.
Bill just, Rainey.
Bill Rainey. It just struck me, and I'd like for Norm to respond to this, and certainly Eric or the others that called in if they want to call back, but I understand that a utility in the Northeast up close there to where you are, I presume you're in Boston, are you not?
That's where we're talking from, yes.
They just negotiated a contract to bring in imported coal, I think South American coal. Now, that utility is going to continue to burn coal, but they're not going to burn coal that comes from West Virginia, which is one of the traditional markets. That's been replaced now because probably of price by South American offshore coal. And that's what's going to occur because there is no alternative today, and I don't foresee one, nor do I think there should be one, to coal being used to generate low-cost, reliable electricity. But the point is that if that coal comes from someplace other than West Virginia, selfishly, from my standpoint, or from America, then it does neither our state nor this country a bit of good, and it's going to continue to be used. And that's the concern that I'm after, and the protection of the guys that I got that depend on a mine operating every day.
Norm Steenstra?
You know, that's the business world touts the advantages of a global economy, and this is one time when it, you know, it is affecting global economics, is affecting a local situation. I think it. I'm sorry, I just lost my thoughts.
That's okay, Norm. Let me throw a question to you though, but I'm going to do it after the break. I'd like you to talk about, and maybe it'll bring you a little bit closer to Bill Rainey. And that is when you were running a small mine. If I did my research correctly, you actually had to close down a small mine because it wasn't economically feasible to keep it open. So you have an idea of the pressures facing the mining industry. And I want to pick that up after the break. We're going to go away and come back. We're also going to be talking to, taking your calls at 1-800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. This is The Connection. I'm Anthony Brooks.
Funding for The Connection is made possible by Macromedia, the software company helping to redefine what the web can be. Available on the web at www.macromedia.com.
From Boston.
This is The Connection. I'm Anthony Brooks. You can join the discussion about coal, the future of coal, at 1-800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK. Connection listeners, if you're listening in Boston, New York, Chicago, or points in between, and you turn on your air conditioner, do you think about what that air conditioner is doing, the demands that it's making on the countrysides of Appalachia? Or do you think about how it's helping a miner keep his job? Or do you just think about how it's helping to keep you cool? We're joined with, we're talking to Norm Steenstra. He's the executive director of the West Virginia Citizens Action Group in the, and Lee Saperstein, dean of the School of Mines and Metallurgy at the University of Missouri in Rolla, and Bill Rainey, president of the West Virginia Coal Association. And let me start with you, Norm. Before the break, I wanted to bring this point up, and that was, you know something about the pressures that the mining industry faces in terms of environmental regulations. Now, I know you're in favor of these regulations, but talk about the very real pressures that it puts on operators of a small mining operation like the one you ran.
I think Bill will agree with me. It's a tremendously competitive industry. It typically overproduces itself, so there's almost always a soft market unless there's some kind of an energy crisis going on or international crisis. I also think Bill will probably agree with me that when I sold coal in the late 70s or 80s, I sold coal for my mine at basically is the same price as he would, as his people are selling it for today. Your electricity, everybody's, you can't think of another commodity, I think, basic commodity that has not increased over a 20-year period of time significantly in price, and coal is a very cheap.
Hmm. Bill Rainey?
I do. I agree with Norm on both those accounts, and it is an enormously competitive industry.
Should we be paying more for coal?
Oh, I'd love for him to pay more for it. That, you know, that would help an awful lot of things, capital investment. But it's a tremendously competitive world right now, and you know, we're hopeful that the market's going to come back and the price will increase.
Lee Saperstein, we need to say goodbye to you, but I want to give you a last word at this. What's the future for this industry? How's it look?
North America has been blessed geologically with great reserves of coal. It is our assurance of energy independence. We, as miners, as technical people, must do our best to get it out of the ground safely. That's for the workers, environmentally, conscientiously. That's for the neighbors, and efficiently, and that's for the customers. A great deal of work and research has gone into this. I've heard people talk today about grasses versus hardwoods, and it just reminds me of all the people who've done very, very fine research projects on it, much of which has now been incorporated into practice. I'm very proud of what people have done in terms of the technology evolution and revolution to try and meet those three goals I spoke of.
Okay, Lee Saperstein, Dean, School of Mines and Metallurgy at the University of Missouri in Rolla. Thank you very much.
Sure.
Connection listeners, 1-800-423-8255 to join this conversation. We're going to Christine, who's on the line from Boise, Idaho. Hello, Christine.
Hi. I just wanted to say I lived in West Virginia for just a few months, and we lived on a street with all the coal miners. And every morning and afternoon, people were out there spraying down their houses because of the thick soot that was on them from the trucks going down each day. And your representative from West Virginia says, well, you know, they wouldn't destroy the environment they're living in. Well, this is their livelihood and the only livelihood they know, and really the only livelihood offered in the area. I mean, the class valedictorian wanted the McDonald's job because it was the best-paying job out there. And my other concern is he is making a point when he says, you know, we're demanding this energy.
Yeah, I think that's an important point. But let me put the first point to our two guests. Bill Rainey, are we asking these miners to make difficult concessions when it comes to their health and so on and their well-being?
That it's a dangerous profession. There's no question about it. It's a mistake-free environment. I think Norm will agree with that, having operated a mine. These skilled workers operate in an environment that is remarkably advanced technologically. It has not necessarily been journalistically represented to be that. There are inconveniences, the dust with truck traffic, but if you live along a highway where there's truck traffic, you have dust. And we are trying desperately in the 23 counties of this state where we produce coal to do a better job and be a better neighbor and make sure that we end up as good as, if not better than, we were before the mining operation was there.
Christine, thank you for your call. Mm-hmm. Let's go to Lynn, who's on the line from Raleigh, North Carolina.
Good morning.
Good morning, Lynn.
I had a few comments. My husband and I both grew up in northern West Virginia. His father's retired from the coal mines, as well as his grandfather and his uncles. My father spent his whole career in a coal-fired generating plant. I actually worked in the coal mine, too. And just on a personal note, we cannot live in West Virginia anymore because of the lack of job opportunities. Even if we wanted to work in the mines, we can't because, for the most part, in our part of the state, they're not operating. And one question that I have is I remember about 15 or 20 years ago, there were quite a few efforts towards gasification of coal, and those were going on to some extent in our area.
Gasification, Lynn, can you help us out with that?
Yeah, it was, I guess, taking the primarily high sulfur coal and converting it to another form, you know, either a liquid form that could be then used you know, to create energy with less pollution.
Hmm.
And I don't know what happened to those efforts.
Well, let's put that to Bill Rainey and Norm Steenstrup. But let me just be clear about what you did. You worked in a – what did you do? What did you specifically do for the coal industry?
Well, I was an engineering student. So I worked underground. I did surveying and, like, time studies and just some general labor.
Hmm. Bill Rainey, can you speak to Lynn's question?
I sure can. There's an Energy Act that's moving through Congress right now being looked at, I think it's in conference, that certainly addresses the liquefaction and gasification of coal. It's not all directed to coal. It's an Energy Act. It's not a coal act. And it's looking at, you know, trying to encourage and provide incentives for people to have plants that will either liquefy or gasify coal by extracting out either the gases or converting it into liquids. And that will then, of course, expand the opportunities of market when you have a different constituent of product. And, you know, that's going on right now. The Department of Energy has been active for years trying to provide, I think, the plant that Lynn's talking about, or one of the plants, was up along the Ohio River, and, you know, it got into the pilot plant project, but it never got to the commercial grade. And what we're doing now, we have a National Energy Technology Lab in Morgantown. That is the Los Alamos, literally, of fossil fuels, and they're looking every day for new ways to utilize coal, cleaner, greener, better way to use it, because it truly is the most secure energy source that we have in this country. There was a study just done that said it is the least subject to any kind of terrorist, if you would use the, you know, that familiar word now, implication of any of the fuels. It's not volatile as it sits in a stockpile. Yeah. It's solid. It's not gaseous. It's not explosive.
Let me put your point, Bill, to Norm Steenstra. Does any of the kind of research that Bill Rainey was talking about, Norm, encourage you in your hope that we can diversify economies and dependence on coal down there?
Oh, I think that's our goal. Any kind of research that goes into making coal burning greener and more or less environmentally offensive is something that I think anybody would embrace. But remember, we still are going to be extracting it. Mm-hmm. And that extraction, as the woman from Boise said, has a quality of life issue as well. Forget just the environment. We can't just think of coal mining as an environmental issue. It's a political issue in West Virginia. It's the strongest lobby in the state. It's the coalfield residents. Bill paints one picture that the miners are very happy and wouldn't follow their nest. I know hundreds and hundreds of people in this state that live next to mountaintop removal jobs that are subjected to blasting, dust, blasting in the middle of the night, loss of water from their well, permanently, you know, depriving them of their water sources. More people, and this is something that we don't really talk about, more people are killed by coal trucks in this state each year than miners who die on the job.
Lynn, thank you for your call. Let's go to Nell, who's on the line from Raleigh, North Carolina. Hello, Nell.
Hi. I have a couple of questions. I have a brother-in-law who's still mining, strip mining in Pennsylvania, Coaldale. And his whole family have been coal miners. Many of them have black lung. I have two questions. To the gentleman who likes his air conditioning, so do I. I live in Raleigh, where it's close to 100 for the last few days. But how many lives and health problems are you willing to trade for your cheap AC? I think that people need to examine their consciences. And to presume that people who live in those conditions, in residents of Coaldale, for example, really have much clout or choice when it comes to supporting their family versus putting up with health problems is, I think, just very outrageous. People who assume that the miners and the residents really have much political clout or voice in those regions should really examine their consciences. That's what I have to say.
Okay, thank you, Nell, for your point. Norm Steenstra, Nell seemed to be talking a little bit about about the point that you were making about the enormous political clout and the helplessness of the folks there in coal country.
Yeah, I don't think I could say it any better. I really appreciate her comments, because it seems like there's a real, as she said, examine your conscience. And, you know, coal is in business to make money. That's their primary goal, and they make money by selling as cheaply as possible a product that makes our electricity.
Bill Rainey, do you get discouraged sometimes when you hear those kinds of calls? I mean, I appreciate the position you're in, but respond to Nell.
It is. You always are trying to be a better neighbor, and you want to be a better neighbor. And, typically they like to dress the coal industry up to be the big bad player and very overpowering. You know, I wish we had as much clout as everybody gives you credit for. That's not the case. And everybody I represent wants to be a good corporate neighbor. It's a tough industry. And when you're moving the kinds of material that are necessary to get the coal to market, it creates inconveniences and it creates some disruptions. And we're doing our best to overcome those. And it's going to be a change. Many of the health problems that have been noted historically from people that are working in the mines have been addressed by legislation. They're paid for by the industry. They're not paid for by general tax dollars. Those have been addressed, and as we've moved through the last 25 to 30 years, many of those items have been taken care of. I go back again to look at the alternative is to pull the coal from another country, going to a utility in the Northeast or in the Southeast, and I contend that no coal in this world has the social expense tied to it and responsibility that a ton of coal from West Virginia does.
Mm-hmm. Let me go back to Nell, our caller from Raleigh, North Carolina. Nell, you say you were from a family of miners.
Yes.
Were they proud of the work? I mean, are they proud of the work they did?
They were proud that they could put food on their table. You're talking about basic human needs, and so many people are unemployed, and the miners go on and off unemployment constantly. So they're constantly living on the edge, and just having a job is pride enough. But I do have a question in response to the coal industry person, and that is, I agree. I think you're caught in a bind, and perhaps the government needs to treat coal and other areas just like we subsidize farmers and other essential products for our human consumption. And I think you shouldn't be caught in a bind. And it maybe needs to be something that needs a much broader perspective and a broader approach than squeezing the guy in the middle.
You know, I think we're going to end today on that comment. Nell, thank you very much for the call. It's a great point to leave us to think about. And I want to thank Bill. I want to thank Bill Rainey, president of the West Virginia Coal Association, for joining us today on The Connection. Thank you, Bill.
Thank you, Anthony.
And Norm Steenstra, executive director of the West Virginia Citizen Action Group. Thank you very much, Norm.
Thank you, Anthony. Bill.
Connection listeners, you can continue this conversation at our website, theconnection.org. The Connection is produced by Sean Carberry, Sarah Fields, Kelly Jones, Allison McAdam, Lindsay Miller, Tara Murphy, Christina Russo, and Doug Sugarts. Our intern are Orit Kurtitsky-Fox, Clint Cavanaugh, and Kara Arsenault. Our senior producer is Graham Smith. I'm Anthony Brooks, in for Dick Gordon. This is The Connection from NPR.
Funding for The Connection is made possible by Macromedia, the software company helping to redefine what the web can be. This is W.